So any questions or digestions or indigestions? The essential. So it has chapters from a lot of different books. The book list goes up tomorrow also, so you can get the spelling. I want to start with a poem from a different guy. Please. Much better, than whatever I have.
It's related to your talk, what you share about your personal story. So what about if you have, you had an experience when you were a child, and you called it once a bad joke, in theory you mentioned it. So you had a bad joke, no matter what joke it was, not necessarily sexual, but it was a bad joke. But there is no memory of this joke. But you know it happened because you lived the waves of the joke all your life. But there's still no, like, nothing to speak about, also with yourself, because the memory is gone. So it makes it much harder to recognize the hook and go through the whole process that you were describing up to where transformation actually happens.
Well, transformation's already happening. The whole, it's not like it only happens at the end. That was actually the question that I asked the Tibetan Rinpoche, who told me later to take it as a bad joke. I said, how can I let go of a memory that I don't have? I didn't have at that point. I didn't have the full thing. So I was, it was after what I told you about, but there was, it all kept coming. And then some of it didn't come. But I just had enough clues that something had happened, but I didn't know everything. And so I said, how do I let go of memory that I don't have? And he said, come talk to me later. Come talk to me later, like to a private interview. This was like a small but public audience. And then he said, take it as a bad joke. So this I mentioned in a talk in Tiruvannamalai in January. That's what she's referring to. And it's a strong thing to say, so I just have to give a little. Because it was 3 years after what I told you about a few days ago, it was a good time for me to hear that statement, take it as a bad joke. Probably, I don't know, but if he, because of who he is, this teacher, with a similar kind of depth, like gravity and levity, depth and lightness as Chögyam Trungpa actually, it could be that he could have said anything and I would have somehow taken it, because it was very loving and very cutting through the crap at the same time. But I think if he'd said that, I don't think he would have said it to me 3 years earlier, but if he would have, I think it would have not gone in very well. It would have been indigestible, probably. So by the time he said it, it was more, time to start moving towards that empowerment thing. That is the possibility of no matter what has happened, being completely free from it. So that it's not like, because it was so bad, I have to keep holding on to it so that I don't betray the child that was hurt. But it's a betrayal of the child that was hurt to keep holding on to it at a certain point. So that's, okay, that's the bad joke thing.
Can you explain?
Wait, I want to answer her question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. My sense is that it's just about meeting the ripples fully. Like knowing that the ripples are a sign of something, and that we said, okay, this, I said a few days ago, this is very personal, and you said your personal story, had the bad, some kind of bad joke. So a deep acceptance of bad joke-ness. And the fact that what you have is not a storyline, but waves. And so that's what you start with, that's what you go on. That's what you talk to. Or if you need to talk about, you talk about. And I would say that you already do so. Since January, at least, that's what I experience. It may not be consciously related in your mind, but... one of the poems that I have for the talk at this point already, so then I'll...
That's okay.
This is part of a poem by Mary Oliver that really does talk about what Sahara is bringing back from my personal talk. So, Mary Oliver says, "For years and years I struggled just to love my life, and then... the butterfly rose weightless in the wind. Don't love your life too much, it said, and vanished into the world." Okay.
I'm not getting it.
Okay, just let it sit. We'll come back to it. Let it sit or fly or whatever.
Oh, speaking of not getting, I want to understand, take it as a bad joke better. Can you maybe explain it a different way?
Well, the poem also explains it a different way. "For years and years I struggled just to love my life. And then, only after that, the butterfly rose weightless in the wind. Don't love your life too much," it said. Don't keep it as a personal story when it's already, when that work is done. It said, and vanished into the world. So it's the thing of, we stay in the seat and we shelter the sadness. We give shelter to our sadness so that it starts to help us learn how to move in the world in a way that doesn't cause more suffering. And then we can give up our seat for joy more easily. Or if we give up our seat for joy, then it's so much easier to have shelter for the sadness. There's so much space for it and so much surprising lightness even with that, however heavy. So, and someone at the time in the talk said, "What do you mean by bad joke? You mean like a joke badly told, or a joke that's not funny, or some other example?" I said, "Yeah, all of those." That talk was like letting go part 3 or 4. And the subtitle was, the secret subtitle that I didn't reveal until the end, was forgiveness. And I just spoke very briefly about the forgiveness. I said, don't do it on purpose, don't try to make it happen. It sometimes happens. And we also could ask, what is it anyway, forgiveness? I really don't know like what it is. In terms of something that we could do on purpose, I'm not sure. But I do like in the traditional forgiveness meditation that they say, you know, you could start with wishing for peace, like wishing for being free of it, or you can find something that you wish for out of any situation. You wish to be healed, you wish to be not weighed down. I think that that's something we can do on purpose. We can connect to the wish that naturally arises out of starting to speak to ourselves about what may have happened or what is happening also. Like, there's also just, as we feel more sensitive, there's also more chance of feeling hurt, the hurt that isn't personal, you know, like what's happening. There's what's always happened, you know, it's not only now that we're so demonic that we've made the world so much worse. It's not really so much worse than before. So we're also not like, it's not impossible to just step by step, though, gradually start to accept our sensitivity and that it does mean that there is hurt that we can feel that isn't mine. And that even so, so it's partly like letting where we meet pain anywhere. I mean, sometimes we meet pain in another person and it's much easier to feel a response than when we meet pain in ourselves. Sometimes we meet pain in ourselves and we get mad at ourselves for being so sensitive and upset or painful. So we do meet pain and there is a response and it's good. Can let that teach us more clearly what we do wish for already and hold that more highly in esteem. Like, sometimes in a difficult situation it's so hard to stay with it in the normal way, which would be mentally, that mental pain reminds us to go deeper, to a deep wish. What do I wish out of the situation? Or what do I wish in my life? Forget about the situation for a while. And even where we've caused pain is painful. And what's the response to that? And what's the deep wish out of that? As a version of forgiveness that we can practice, that we can feel for. And I think that as we allow ourselves, as we are allowed to feel what I wish for anyway, or even what I wish for because of this difficulty. So whether it's in reaction to being hurt or hurting myself, whether it's in reaction to that, I think it helps the emotional charge come down. And then we start to be able to learn in another way where, and it's partly because we see that actually nothing has been taken away from me, nothing essential has been taken away from me, no matter what's happened to me. And also, no matter what I've done to myself or another. And there can start to come a more wholeness of acceptance that these things happen, even if there may be not any explanation of why. And then the emotional charge can come down again a little more. And so then there's less reaching out to blame somebody, because it's a little bit less uncomfortable. And then I think two things start to happen, and one is that we start to understand how the things happen. We start to, at least mentally, and sometimes we can really feel the part of the other person that we've hurt or who's hurt or whatever. Because then even the worst crimes start to be understandable, and that's scary. It's scary to feel wholeness. Like, we want to be wholeness with, like, the beautiful green forest as long as we don't hear the leopard, you know, or whatever. But actually wholeness with all there is as it is includes criminals who are just human beings. He explains his crime in a way that's very open and honest, and he also doesn't know how that could have happened, what he did, he himself. And so first you're just left with that, with him. And then later on, as if it were unconnected, he just describes how one day his mother drove out to the countryside and left him and his brother on a porch somewhere and drove away, and he never saw her again. And he was like 6 or 8 years old. As if there's no connection between the two things, and of course, how could there not be? But I still don't call this forgiveness. Like, being uncomfortable in the wholeness with everyone and everything as it is. Understanding how things do happen. And then the second thing that I think we start to notice as the emotional charge gradually comes down, or sometimes comes down rather, sometimes it goes back up, is what I mentioned in that talk, the personal talk, about empowerment and the hook. So we start to, without it being like that it, whatever happened was all my fault, but we do start to be able to feel more honesty about our part in various, sometimes really subtle dynamics that have sometimes really serious consequences. And I think that honesty, do you know what I mean? I heard nice sounds, but I wasn't sure if it was a yes or a no. Does someone catch it and can bring it back?
What you were saying, you spoke of being aware of the honesty, of your honesty, and understanding how, however subtle, you might have played a part in what happened. Something like that.
Okay. So, kind of, but I think the difference is of what I want to say today. That's clearly what I was trying to say about my experience last time. And now what I want to say more specifically is, as the honesty grows, that there could have been some things that I did differently and it could have come out differently. Not that I should have, not that it's my fault, etc. But as that honesty comes into place, there's more awareness on the daily basis now of the so many little subtle tricks that we're into that have sometimes really serious consequences for ourselves and others. So we think it's not a big deal to just be a little self-absorbed or a little whatever. But if we actually are honest, we can follow through and feel actually, whoa, that had a serious effect on that person and on myself. Not saying that one word at that time or saying that. Or so just starting to catch the really nonverbal movements that we could almost feel as it may be even as if our biology is kind of throwing us around a bit. And just being willing to notice it. So it's really not our fault if it's biology. Like what else other way do we have to be here and to live, you know? We have to have the body. And the body has to have some life energy and biology and sexuality and survival instinct and fear of death. And
in 2009, I was here and you spoke about it. And you said in that conversation that somehow, I remember you said, we're all moved by our will to be loved, and it just kind of gets twisted on the way and we kind of get lost. So the will of all of our actions, everybody's always to be loved, and it just kind of gets, we get lost somehow. Mm-hmm.
So let's pause, because I don't know if anyone could hear you. So she's remembering 4 years ago?
Yeah.
When I spoke about something similar, the way I said it, if I remember correctly, was maybe, what if, our entire motivation in life is to get love. And it just gets twisted. And what I would say today in this like series of talks in these 2 weeks is the hypocrisy that happens with our desire for love. Our desire is a loaded word. Our impulse towards love, our push towards love, towards trying to get love, or towards love. And so something symbolizes love to me, and so I might, in a contracted way, grab out for it. But because I'm contracted, there's no way that symbol of love can actually reach what wants the love. Or because I want you to show me a symbol of love, that you like me or approve of me or whatever. So then I try to trick you, I try to impress you, I try to do something that you like so that you'll give me a symbol of love. And again, because I'm tricking you,
are you tricking yourself as well?
I'm not in an honest place, and so then there's no chance for, it's like some kind of valve that if I'm tricking, it's closed. And so it's about how beautiful we are as vulnerable people. And how how tricky we are. So the second thing?
So does it make sense that anyone that's, I don't know if it's interpreted or mixed or turned over to hurt, all to pain? Like
if anger gets turned over to pain, hurt?
Yeah, like instead of feeling angry or instead of knowing your
this is another, as usual, another chapter of the talk is being opened by a question, which probably, again, you couldn't hear. So I'm going to ask you to say it to them this time, if maybe you turn around and...
So my question is...
More loudly.
That, does it make sense, or does it not make sense that anger becomes immediately pain, and then you don't even feel angry, you just feel incredibly hurt, and then is it denying the anger, or is it a more subtle way of perceiving already?
Yeah, thank you. So I don't want to put limitations even on anger, but I think most of the time that when we feel the anger, what we feel as we go in is hurt behind it, or fear of being hurt. And this is where maybe now we could talk about forgiveness. Let's also not put limitations on what forgiveness might be, but maybe one part of forgiveness is when it's not for anyone else that I give up my defense. That it's not because my defense was hurting you and keeping you out, but when the defense can dissolve from the inside for the goodness of what's inside. So when the defense can fall down for our own protection, even. When the defense can fall down for our own security, let's put it that way. In the sense of relief from the deep insecurity that we live otherwise. So another way to say it is when the deep insecurity that usually runs our show gets so old or tiring, or we can feel how painful it is finally. Our sensitivity allows us to feel how painful it is to be run by insecurity and therefore defensiveness, protection, hiding, attacking, etc. Survival mode. That for my own good, so to speak, it's not even mine anymore, but for the good of the life that's trapped in there, and because it's not working, defense is dissolving. But when I say security, I only mean in contrast to the deep insecurity that usually runs us into exhaustion all the time. I don't mean security in that you will never meet a criminal, or you will never hurt yourself or betray yourself or whatever. It doesn't mean there won't be hurt.
Say again, wherein lies the security?
It lies in the confidence that staying connected to the life stream is what living is precious, is all there is.
And it's safe.
And it's safe in the way that it would be safe, like the teacher that says, oh, dying. Oh, don't worry, it's totally safe. It's like totally safe in that way. So totally safe in that we're with what's untouchable and shakable, at least to some extent, and maybe we can dive in, or fall in, rather. But it's not that the stretch doesn't hurt. And so a lot of our confusion comes from equating, so saying that love is equal to pleasure. Love is equal to my symbols, my attention and care and belonging. Or love is equal to some limited thing. Does it make sense? So another way to say it is confidence in life, confidence in living. Another way to say it is confidence in freedom. Confidence that freedom is what is needed more than anything else. Not freedom to do what I want, when I want, necessarily. Is life growing our confidence even when we didn't think we were quite ready for that? And so the love of, whether it feels like the love of my freedom, sometimes it might feel like the love of the freedom of this, and sometimes it feels more like that life demands freedom. It isn't without that freedom. So I have the poem that I thought I was going to read at the beginning. There's an Australian cartoonist, Michael Lunig, who used to write political cartoons for the newspaper. At a certain point in his life, there was some kind of intensity. And he kind of thought, well, whatever, I'm gonna do something different now. I'm not gonna bother with the political cartoons, I'm gonna do something else. But he still did cartoons, and he did cartoon prayers in the newspaper, which it could sound really traditional, but since it wasn't, like the figure for God or the soul or like divine intervention or whatever was usually a duck, for example, like a little duck. It was not at all a conservative prayer cartoon in it. It was as bizarre as it sounds. A subversive prayer in a cartoon style in a newspaper. So all of those layers are, I think, a very good joke. And I just love this one prayer poem cartoon that I also read in Tiru, Vanamalai, on that retreat. So he says, God, give us rain when we expect sun. Give us music when we expect troubles. Give us tears when we expect breakfast. Give us dreams when we expect a storm. Give us a stray dog. That means a dog that's lost. Give us a stray dog. When we expect, anyone want to guess? Just for fun.
A lover?
Let's have a few, just for fun. Fill in the blanks. Don't try to guess what he said. What would you put?
Gulab jamun.
A lover.
A visit from a loved one.
Sleep. Yes, exactly. We're just inside our sleeping bag and just the right position. And then... Give us a stray dog when we expect congratulations. God, play with us. Turn us sideways and around. Amen.
And around what?
Amen. That one I could have done at the... Well, isn't it easy to find that in India, and isn't it hard to find it outside of India, but isn't it always there? It's more obvious here, but why? I think it's the sense of humor. I think it's the sense of humor that's possible, because the expectations are different. In the West, when we're expecting a document to come out of the printer and it doesn't,
but a duck does,
then it doesn't as easily put us in touch with that place, with the duck or whatever.
Sounds like.
But why?
Because it usually works there. Yeah.
Because it works so often that the expectation is so firm. Also, but Indians aren't on holiday mode.
No.
And they're like, okay, yeah. Tomorrow coming.
Yeah.
1 hour after.
Tomorrow. It's like the Middle East.
It's well. Like so many places. It's like what we call the third world, that's the two-thirds world, yeah. As one of my friends said. And we have this sense of ourselves in the, whatever you want to call it, post-industrial dominant mainstream, whatever. As if it's the, because it's so dominant, it's the culture. And we get up out of our seat for that white guy on the bus every time. Instead of laughing at the duck, you know, and laughing with the duck.
Would you share that?
God give us rain, and I'll write it. When we expect sun, give us music when we expect troubles. Give us tears when we expect breakfast. Give us dreams when we expect a storm. Give us a stray dog when we expect congratulations. God, play with us. Turn us sideways and around. Amen.
Was there a picture to go with that?
I don't think so. Not in the book that I saw. I don't know if the original in a newspaper had a picture. And it's actually a lovely book called A Common Prayer, which is taking off from the Common Prayer book, but just letting prayer be common in a newspaper, not belonging to any religion. And also, like, bringing in the possibility of this unexpected at the breakfast table, you know, not only when we are ready to expect the unexpected. What is it that makes any dream, whether sleeping or waking, what makes any dream a good dream? But now you tell them directly.
Okay, so I wanted to tell you, so I had a dream yesterday. I'll just say it very shortly, mm-hmm. that I was in China or something like that, and there was a huge earthquake and all the buildings were collapsing. So it started, I don't know, I was trying to prevent it or something, and then I was sitting on a rooftop, but I couldn't see if I'm sitting on a high rise or not, but I was just seeing like everything collapsing. It was like a disaster. It was horrible, but I was sitting on this rooftop and I knew nothing was going to happen to me,
mm-hmm.
and I was just like there, and then when the earthquake finished, I was sitting on a like short buildings neighborhood, the old kind 70s neighborhood, and the only buildings that survived were these buildings and a building of children's house. And it was very clear, and it was like tsunami, but I was there and I just knew nothing was going to touch me, and I thought like it really,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so I woke up really like,
yeah.
So I kind of feel that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So sometimes there's a knowing that actually nothing is going to happen in terms of we're not going to get hurt, even though it looks like we are, and we can stay true to that. And sometimes it's that deeper staying true to the untouchable, unshakable, that even though I am being hurt, what I'm deeply called upon in this life to live is what isn't. Believing that. And even using that story that hurts to keep finding the place that isn't. So that fearlessness and love of life and that part of you that probably in the dream was like, I'm ready to let go of all of those new buildings.
Also, can I say
yeah,
I
please.
Had one more dream, like mm-hmm. a couple of days before that, that was super intensive, that was like sexual molestant and mm-hmm. people were like carving with knives.
Don't get too
stomach.
Explicit because people are in retreat and it can get intense.
And when I woke up, I felt like I couldn't leave the bed because it was so
yeah.
intense. Like I really... But it kind of felt like I felt so much relaxed after.
Mm-hmm.
And so it also kind of connected
mm-hmm.
to that.
Mm-hmm.
That like after I felt like it was something I had to go through
mm-hmm.
and it happened and now I'm like
mm-hmm.
outside of me.
Good.
So,
good. So. Great. So that's a nice thread of to bring in of even when it looks not just messy but awful as a story, there may be in staying true to something else, like something else. Anyone else play with dreamlike waking?
I've had this dream several times, and in the dream, everything is spinning around, and they're like papers and furniture,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and just everything is all around. And it's just going around and around and around and around. And then to me, in the dream, where I am is the safest place to be. And so I'm just happy and I'm just looking at all this stuff. And then I wake up and I think, oh, why did I wake up? It's happened twice.
Good.
Pretty much the same.
Similar, like noticing that there could be stillness in a storm. Were you raising your hand, Kelly? So the sense in a dream of that what matters is the full connection, full, what word would you use? Care, presence, yeah, care, presence, attention. If you look at Kylie when she was speaking, that would have helped to get, because those words are right, but also not quite. There's some kind of really live connection that we can be with, that you could call presence or you could call full participation. Giving ourselves fully into this right now with not at all wondering how it's going to come out, what's going to come next, because in a dream it could be anything. And it's just more clear that it's not, that's not our job. She said it better, sorry, I couldn't carry it over. And there's another part about what Kylie is saying is the continuity that's important and possible. So, and that's why the words attention and presence are not quite right, because when I feel I'm attentive and present in my normal waking, there's usually a sense of I'm fully present for this time, and then I rest. Something else happens that I'm not fully present with, and then, oh, look how present I am, kind of thing. And in the dream, it's also that any little thing could be of great significance. What seems like really important could be not important. What seems really dangerous could be not dangerous, or because it's not going to affect you, or because it's something that's powerful that's getting released or finding its place or whatever. Like, and so there's this more fun, awake, actually could be a good word, awake to the what's happening right now in that dreamlike way. Open in a very, like a precise openness, an open precision. That because, I think it's exactly because it's not at all involved in what's going to come, what's the future, what's the effect. It has its own gas, it has its own petrol, it has its own fuel, and brightness and clarity. So I'm not paying attention to this now, because that, so that that will happen later. Just this for itself. Yeah? Yeah.
I wasn't going to refer to the dreams I was having, but more of the, I really connect with the concept of our reality being dreamlike. Your line that you gave,
yeah.
Was enough to open the space for that.
So just, let's just pause there already, because you can't all see him, and just the fact that he said it can open, he went like this, it can open the space, as an indication of what is the quality that would be happening when he was up here with his hands opening a space, very simply. But that's also part of what Kali was saying. It's good to have these different ways of saying it, because it's simple and hard to put into words.
And so actually that evening was very kind of a powerful, insightful experience with it just seemed that there was like just one thing dreaming it all up, just one dreamer, or that which is dreaming, and so seeing the wholeness of it, the oneness of it, and how everything is just a reflection of everything else.
Yeah.
It's just very, and it just gives, for me, it just gives everything a very mysterious, like a flavor of being a great mystery.
Yeah. So again, the letting things be a mystery, like that, not trying to figure it out and get to know what's happening and following a storyline, and also that the sense of the, you say wholeness or oneness, that like in a dream, it could even have meaning or not, but there's not a strong looking for the meaning. It's being so saturated with the color of what's happening that includes and allows the colorfulness of what's going on inside and outside. So in a dream, you could be my mother, like either you could signify my mother, or you could turn into my mother the next second. And then suddenly it's Lenny who, and if I try to tell the dream, it's like, oh, well, anyway. Then Bernie was Lenny and it was my, and it just like, what? But in the dream, we're not, that doesn't make sense. I'm not going crazy. Oh my God. We're just, it's the, like the Vajra quality of so colorful and rich that we actually don't need to bother to make a story to make it seem rich. It's so rich and we're absorbed into it. wholeness that can mean and not mean, and it's all okay, and it can mean so many things that also could not matter. So we can feel from the dreamlike quality and what we've been saying about the waking dream, how there isn't any moment where our attitude is not important. We can get that from the dream thing. In the dream, it's more clear to feel that my attitude is almost all that makes my experience of what's happening. If I know that the buildings are going to all fall down, but I'm safe, and I just stay with that and let the buildings fall down.
Did that come from books?
Nope.
I mean, I have a...
But it can be part of letting our tenderness have us back. There isn't a moment that our attitude doesn't make a difference. And so we can't stop the attitude sometimes. We can't change the attitude, but we can know that it's making a difference in a dreamlike way. We don't have to freak out about it. But then it's also that the attitude is like maybe just another character in the dream. And then what? So like that fullness of that character, that can help us stay with the continuous, sinuous, precise. Go ahead. So in one of the meditations, maybe yesterday in the morning, I talked about allowing the quality of what we love in life, or of the living quality, to let it be intense. So also when we spoke about the Vajra quality, about the Vajra nature, Chögyam Trungpa quotations about how rich and intense and radiant our true nature is. And I just was helping to bring out the possibility that sometimes we'll be like, well, it's good, like it's okay, and we don't quite leave room for the intensity of how good, how honest, how precise, how real, how hard. And so Kailash's experience is a good example of what is possible. That could even come to sound nearly like inhumane, so cold. But in the Indian spiritual tradition, they have this, like the same word for Himalaya, the abode of snows, the place where the snows live, you can say. The Him, or the Hem, is the snow. And it's sometimes used as a description. For experiencing that kind of, let's say, behind the scenes clarity. And sometimes we could say, oh, well, because India is so hot, that the cold quality would be given as a soothing and nice, you know. But I think it's also an actual raw description of our experience. That there can be, it's not just cool and fresh, but it's like, like if you've ever been in the water in Gangotri. So I want to share another few lines from Jogyam Trungpa. If I can find which mark is the one. no idea. Here it is. So he talks in a helpful way, I find, about what he calls sore spots. So spots in us that hurt and that are open. And so the first step is noticing, a little bit like we did when we tried to feel what's the experience of beauty. And he would say, what's the experience of love? Even if it's like love of my cup of chai, and why did you not let me have it at 3:30, and why is there not enough to have three cups at 4:45? Well, because the poor guy who was carrying it dropped it and spilled it all over himself, and there's only half, so sorry about that. Even the love of something that gets a little bit edgy when we don't get it, so a very limited love. There's an openness that Jogyam Trungpa talks about as some kind of opening is good enough. It doesn't matter what it is love of, as long as there is a sore spot, an open wound, that's good. That is where all the germs could get in and begin to impregnate and take possession of us and influence our system. So it's again talking about the defenses coming down in a pretty funny way. He's making fun of our paranoia about hygiene and individualism. And he follows that immediately with, to explain the joke, that is precisely how the compassionate attitude supposedly takes place. He says supposedly, meaning it does take place that way. It's not like a trick. So we can harvest from the different ways that we are already open, the openness, and the way that it does let life in. And then he says, not only that, but there's also an inner wound, which is called Tathagata Garbha, which he translates here as Buddha nature. Tathagata Garbha, literally, Garbha is womb. Garbha. And womb is the place where the babies, where we all grew our bodies inside our mothers, to get to the point, basically. And it's also, I think, related to the word for home, ghar, which is spelled differently, but I think it's related, I seem to remember. So that you don't feel left out if you don't have a womb, but you grew in a womb, so you have womb connection. So you know what he's talking about, garbha. Tathagata is... We could say that in us that's already fully living, already untouchable. And careful, honey, that's the recorder right there. You're a little too on time. Can you wait a few minutes?
No.
So it's what's already inborn in us, we could say pregnant with that, or it's already inborn in us, that we're already beyond. And that already we are whole with things as they are. So as it is, so it is here. But then he describes Tathagata Garbha. It's all one word. It's not like you get a break in between Tathagata Garbha. Tathagata Garbha is like a heart, that sounds nice, that is sliced, that means cut, and bruised, which means like banged so that it hurts, that it's sore, by wisdom and compassion. So by the openness that is continuous, that doesn't stop, that we can't get away from. By the way that I'm not only seeing but being seen. By the way that I don't even know what is seeing through my eyes. What is it that's seeing through my eyes? There's nowhere that we're not exposed already. And so that's when we start to be like, what am I doing with all this defense? If already it's all inside me too, and it's also seeing me from outside. And it's also not trying to harm. But it does slice. When the external wound and the internal wound begin to meet, so that love of something, and the fact that we're also open on the inside beyond what we might wish sometimes, when they begin to meet and to communicate, this is another answer to your question. Then we begin to realize that our whole being is made out of one complete sore spot altogether. So this is the defense comes falling down. Not that we took it apart or tried to get rid of it, but it comes falling down. But what it feels like is that we're one complete sore spot. That vulnerability is compassion. We really have no way to defend ourselves anymore at all. It is the living flame of love. And then he says, if you'd like to call it love, what is love? Who knows what love is? Never mind, kind of. It's a vague word. Okay. And I just want to continue a little bit further. There is a slit in our skin, so that's like a cut. A slit gives a sense of a kind of a clean cut, also. A wound. It's very harsh treatment, hard, harsh treatment, in some sense, but on the other hand, it's very gentle. The intention is gentle, but the practice is very harsh. By combining the intention and the practice, you are being harshed, and also you are being gentled. That makes you into a bodhisattva. You have to go through that kind of process. You have to jump into the blender. He doesn't stop, you know, he's like, okay, and he's like, nope. He just goes more. It is necessary for you to do that, just jump into the blender and work with it. You might even enjoy it a little bit after you've been processed. Let's have that be enough. So I think that's forgiveness. That's what I think forgiveness is. That's what I think forgiveness is. To jump into the blender, to get processed, to start to even enjoy. And it's not enjoying it just because purely it's intense and harsh. It's that, what I said before about what, like unlocking that, the freedom inside and the love of freedom inside. And how that freedom is equal to what we are. That's the Tathagata Garbha. It's unlocking that freedom and love of freedom. And so it's to correct partly, sometimes people think of open dharma retreats or about gentleness and it's so nice and it's so gentle and then therefore whenever it gets a little bit uncomfortable, it's like, oh, but what about the gentleness? It's like, well, the gentleness absolutely calls for and works with and is complementary and not even separate from the harshing. And it's not that the harshness isn't gentle. It's like a surgery, actually. But there does seem to be this point that there is not anesthesia in that surgery. That there's something important about just meeting that intensely powerful experience. And so sometimes that brings us to a point where there's a feeling of like, oh, this is my life. And my whole life matters. And other times it's the feeling of this is not my life. And so it doesn't matter. And the way that those are the same thing, like, is forgiveness, let's say. Okay, so any question left, or any word, digestion, indigestion? Oof. The whole thing? If I can find the napkin. I won't read the whole thing. So there's the, it doesn't matter what it is love of, as long as there is some kind of opening, some sore spot, where all the germs can get in. To impregnate and take possession of us and influence our system. So that's partly saying that it's not just like discussion on an idea level. But that is how the compassionate attitude, which is what you're interested in right now, supposedly takes place. By letting the love of something be there and letting that openness get me into a mess, basically. And then, yeah, Yanni likes the blender part. And not only that, there's an inner wound that is our Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha. Like a heart that's sliced and bruised by wisdom and compassion. The external wound and the internal wound begin to meet and to communicate, and we begin to realize that our whole being is completely made of a sore spot. Which means, I'm going to comment now, there is just total openness. There is already compassion in all directions. There is a love of freedom, the readiness to let the earthquake take everything down without being hurt by it somewhere, and it hurts. No, stop. We're getting to the cutting, just wait. The inner wound is either, you could say, our potential wisdom and compassion, or where already there is either our potential wisdom and compassion, if it's still unborn, or we're ignoring it, repressing it, denying it, reacting against it. we could just say our vulnerability. Yeah, our vulnerability and our love of, when they meet. Then we become more interested in the openness, basically, and the transformation that happens from the openness and precision of and that, like what Kylie was describing. That, here we go. That then, he says we really have no way to defend ourselves anymore at all. What's happened is that our defenses have obviously become irrelevant. It's ridiculous. It's a joke.
All chop it up.
And so, it's okay. And so there's a slit, a It's very harsh treatment in some sense, but on the other hand, it's very gentle. The intention is gentle. The practice is very harsh. This is maybe the more important thing. So because the intention is gentle, we think, oh, it's going to be really nice and easy because it's all so gentle. And that when it isn't, and it actually is really harsh, feeling, even when it is a beautiful experience, it's harsh. The stretch. It's too much, like we talked about the other day. It's too much whether it's good, and it's too much whether it's bad. It's too much, and it hurts, and it stretches, and it's harsh. Yeah? So that expectation can be seen through. By combining the intention and the practice, so following through on our love of freedom, we get harshed and gentled, both together. That makes you a bodhisattva. You have to go through that kind of process. You have to jump into the blender. Just jump into the blender and work with it. Which means also that there's no way to know how it's going to be. We can't prepare ourselves to jump into the blender. In fact, we can't even jump, we fall. When we're not looking, we fall in and like, oh, everything's spinning around. Then you will begin to feel that you're swimming in the blender. You might even enjoy it a little bit after you've been processed. So an actual understanding of ultimate, he calls bodhicitta, we can call it freedom mind, or the quality that we've been talking about for the dreamlike quality in the waking state, only comes from compassion. In other words, a purely logical, professional, or scientific conclusion doesn't bring you to it. Oops. Okay, let's end with a very short silence. May all beings be at peace, and may our lives and practice be dedicated together to the liberation of all.